Welcome to the Signals Podcast, a monthly transmission of future frameworks for cross-cultural design. I am your host, Elia Vargas. To build a more inclusive, accessible, and global digital future, we need new frameworks for technological development. Every month, Signals broadcasts insights from visionaries at the forefront of creative inquiry and design innovation about how emerging technology can support cross-cultural connection. What do cultural production and co-creation look like today? What about in 2050? What does cultural exchange mean in the digital age? How do technocultures contribute to or corrode a shared global cultural exchange? How can the nascent technological domains of artificial intelligence, extended reality, big data, and Web3 contribute positively to the planet? Can technocultural exchange tackle the pressing crises of climate change, xenophobia, assault on women's rights, and the crisis of imagination facing the world today? From the San Francisco Bay Area and beyond, these are some of the questions we will tackle. Dorothy R. Santos is a Filipino-American storyteller, poet, artist, and scholar. Welcome, Dorothy. It's my privilege to have you. Thank you so much for joining the Signals podcast.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here and in conversation about, my goodness, the world that we live in that seems like a lot for us to deal with on a daily basis. Yeah, as you mentioned, there's ways forward, and I always feel that there's a way when put in conversation with people that are looking to affect change, I see you as someone like that. So thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for saying that. And you make it sound like doing the kind of work that needs to be done is so plausible and possible. I mean, my goodness, your work is so dang prolific. And by the way, everyone, not included in that bio is the fact that Dorothy is part of the inaugural YBCA 10 program from 2021. Speaking of change makers, that is an incredible award, grant, fellowship. What would you call it, Dorothy?
Very much an experience. It encompasses those things. But yes, I guess you can say fellowship would probably be the most appropriate.
I mean, already we're just diving into like a mixture of a bunch of things, but let me ask you a grounded question here. Your work spans such a broad spectrum of areas. You're working in artistic practice, academic scholarship, the art and tech nonprofit sector. You used to work in the biotech industry. Can you talk about some of the common themes that bring the work together for you? Why do you work in all of these different areas? Like, how does that happen? And also, why is it important to you?
I've never been asked that question that actually incorporates looking back at the biotech side of my life. And the reason why I mention that is because I oftentimes feel that's more of an afterthought, because people are more curious about, oh, you're looking at critical medical anthropology, but why would you be looking at that if you're looking at voice recognition or assistive tech? And a lot of what I'm interested in, it almost feels as though I've come upon these things by just mere circumstance, sometimes not intentionally. When I worked in biotech, and I won't go through the whole gamut of experiences related to that, but I did it because, you know, I was trying to survive and wanting to work, you know, in an industry where not only maybe I could, you know, learn and grow. And that's changed a lot because I obviously have critiques of how science functions, especially in the past few years, given the global pandemic that we all still find ourselves in. But what that experience did give me, because my intention was to survive and to support family, because a lot of, I think what we do, many of us do that, you know, we do the work that we do because, you know, we're trying to live a particular type of life. But what happened was my curiosity in different systems and infrastructure of what makes biotech run and function is what became most fascinating to me. And even my own work, when I think back on the lineage or the throughways and the threads of why am I so fascinated by voice? You know, when I was in biotech, one of the things that was necessary was interactive voice response systems to collect data from clinicians for the clinical trials. And I became engrossed by the fact that, wow, if I change a number in one platform, that changes the whole drug supply for one site just by changing a number, or by having a data coordinator at a site mispronounce something and then it messes up an entire data set. Do you know what I mean? It's like these little things that I started to connect together that the voice enables or maybe disables that became one of the threads that I find myself working in. I will say originally the dissertation and the work I wanted to do, and maybe in the future this will be the case, I actually wanted to look at DNA as media. And I was deeply inspired by your own research and scholarship and your own artistic practice, actually, when you were looking at, say, oil as media and kind of not just as kind of the, you know, differentiations between the types of oil and how it has served its purpose for humanity and non-human species and even just the earth and, you know, the substrates from which you can find it within. I started to think very deeply about DNA in a very similar fashion, but I changed course because obviously when you're doing dissertation work, you have mentors that tell you, oh, you have five good ideas, you need to pick one. And so I ended up picking something that for me was top of mind and something I had already been engaging in, which was voice. And yeah, so I feel like I said everything and nothing at all. And I only gave a little tidbit of how that all connects with like my past and my intentions with it. But I mean, I definitely want to keep going and seeing where the conversation goes and leads us.
I mean, I think front and center in your work, which is maybe rendered clear in the piece that you had in Art Journal called Domain Errors, is the question of how some aspect or attribute of the specificities of bodies are rendered legible or not, whether they are rendered agencies over themselves or not, or in the case of domain errors, visible or invisible. And so for this, thinking about how like if I just read your bio, for example, like what are the common threads as you are simultaneously an academic researcher, an artist presenting your work, and a mentor and advisor for different individuals, students, institutions. I mean, Dorothy, you're such a respected and knowledgeable art steward in the Bay Area surrounding art and technology. And as I look at the breadth of the spaces in which you occupy, which part of the function of this podcast, right, is getting at this question of like, what is technoculture and what is global technoculture and what kind of constructive exchanges can happen within technoculture, that the specific fact that you are a Filipina woman identifying person whose work is really focused on, in many ways, feminist science studies, right? Like, or like medical anthropology and feminist medical anthropology. Like, how do all of these different places in your configuration of what technocultures is, how do they mobilize you to do or not do different things? How do you end up serving as the board member of one area while you're also doing voice-oriented poetry and games as text art?
Yeah, I think a lot of people wonder that. So thank you for asking me that. I hopefully people will listen and get a broader, much more, you know, maybe the answer that they like, but I think it always changes because we're always ever evolving. I feel it also depends on who you're speaking with and to and for whom. You know, you always want to be very careful you know, to not do that. And I think it's, you know, I mean, even kind of you and I being in film and digital media and thinking about Trent Tiemann-Ha's work of speaking nearby or not speaking for anyone. And so I feel a lot of my practices as someone who is, you know, steeped in a research practice as well as a creative practice, which I feel came much later on. I always really wanted to make art, but coming from an immigrant Filipino family, that was not something that was readily available in a multitude of ways. I think it's also just seen as, and I think in many ways, even through the pandemic, you know, making art for I'm speaking for myself, I'm not speaking for anyone, but oftentimes I would have this contentious feeling of being and feeling self-indulgent, but at the end of the day, also realizing, and you and I are both, you know, have our a shared mentor, Anna Friz, who has said to me in previous years, sometimes you need to step back and away from the world in order to really process and to understand it so that you can kind of, you know, re-enter it in a way that is generative or contributing, and or in if you're lucky enough and have the bravado to do it, you intervene. And I think in many ways, the kind of expanse of me working in docu-poetics, which is a modality, actually, I was doing research about that. It's not perceived as a genre, it's perceived as a modality because there is no real lineage. I think a lot of people have been doing storytelling for so long, but working from docu-poetics to creating interactive, you know, pieces and games and text-based games, because I've always loved Choose Your Own Adventures since I was a kid. And then working in voice and learning how to, oh, how do you bend and flex the frequencies to be able to kind of have some kind of affect that would affect your listener? And I feel that we can be all those things. I've grappled with that for a long time, people saying, oh, you don't just do just one thing, but why be limited? And I think I've learned so much from my experiences working within the open source software movement and space. And also I appreciated your word steward in describing me, because I don't like to think of ownership and authorship as something that is solely me. I even in Cyborg's Prosody, I am inspired by from the Filipino call center workers doing Western vocal drag in the Philippines to my own mother's story of how she felt a lot of tension, loss, and grief around learning a different type of way of speaking when she immigrated here, and, you know, and me taking those stories and kind of transforming them in such a way where, you know, and my mom actually said this, she says, if you ever do anything, if you ever make artwork about or do writing about my life, you have to change everything. And I think that kind of, it's actually funny. I will stop there, but I will say when my mom said that, when you asked me how I felt about being in conversation with you, one of the things you said is, oh, you want me to produce a question for the next guest. It actually, that next question, it came from doing this work based on my mother's life, actually. So I'm excited to actually, I want the conversation to last as long as possible, obviously, but I can't, also, it's exciting to get to that point in our conversation later.
Yeah, keep it in. That's going to be at the end. And yeah, we don't want to, I like the little tease of what is to come, but let's not give away the ending. Who cares about postmodernism? You know, it's that's not the modality we're in anymore. Anyway, you started talking about the Cyborg's Prosody, and I want to ask you about that. But first, kind of leading into that, while we're still kind of trying to hold all of the different aspects of your practice together in one space, because I know that's really impossible, and it's by virtue of the fact that they're very different areas, they facilitate very different functions, bureaucracies, practices, algorithms, etc. So the fact that you operate in all these different places makes you such a wonderful person to ask this question to, which is, what is technocultures? Like, what does that even mean?
I mean, on the face of it, it's very difficult to answer because it's kind of, I keep going back to this phrase, well, I just said everything and nothing at all. And oftentimes when people ask me, because the other side of that is, I haven't been asked to define technoculture, but I have been asked to define digital culture. I think the reason why the opportunity to think about what technocultures or a technoculture means is it allows for a little bit more breadth and expansion, because it's anything to me that provides a type of technology. And one of the first things that come to mind is thinking about my mom, you know, growing up on, you know, in the Philippines on a farm, and her relationship to human and non-human beings and the way that she would describe her life when she was growing up. It's so much of the type of thinking or quote unquote innovation that happens in Silicon Valley. I feel that, you know, my mother's been doing that for decades. And then if you think about that, there's so many indigenous practices around the world that have engaged in a type of techno culture. I think about some of the things that my mom has done, even just to mind the garden, you know, in the backyard. We have a home in San Francisco. We still have a home in San Francisco where I grew up, and she lives there. And even a lot of the things that she does on a day to day, these are not things that my mom learned on by watching a YouTube tutorial. Because I feel that can, when I think of technoculture, I think immediately of what is outside the digital that actually contributes to what digital culture is, and then how it then is defined, sometimes maybe perpetuated because of capitalism and free enterprise, or we can make money off of this. It's, I mean, I just said it capitalism, but you know, I think of things outside of that. When I think of technoculture, I also, maybe, and this is just the byproduct of being more mature and getting older and having a deep respect for elder knowledge, I also think, I'll raise this other issue because I feel like there's so much more to say about this. But another aspect of technoculture that I think of is, you know, I was at an artist residency earlier this year in Banff in Alberta, Canada. And I was a part of a cohort. We were focused on computational writing. So what does it mean to write with machines and you know, create text generators, et cetera? How does that look? And one of the activities that they had us do was actually go on a medicine walk. And for me, that was so illuminating because as we were going through this walk with Brenda Holder, her grandmother was a medicine woman, actually. And she said something, my cohort members said, oh, well, what does that plant do over there? You didn't talk about that. You mentioned it, but what does that plant do over there? And she said, oh, I can't tell you that. That is for our tribe. We try to preserve the plant life and honor it in such a way that it, you know, so we keep those secrets and those remedies and a lot of this like was essentially like spell work, you know, because I really do believe that when people think of spell work, they think of the occult, but spell work's like everything. Like even programming can be a spell work, you know, because it's words and characters and actions, even though you're not creating sigils on a keyboard, it's very similar. But even that, like that in and of itself, to me, that's a type of technoculture. Yeah. And so that's kind of what I wanted to share, that to me, the things oftentimes that are technoculture are the things outside of the digital.
Words become extraordinarily malleable. So I don't know if it's helpful to give another word. I mean, you just gave such a wonderful description. Like digital culture can also include the practices surrounding digital culture, right? Like desktop phenomenology, media archaeology of a computer mouse. I mean, I know that you spoke at a conference last year sometime oriented kind of around that sort of question. And all of these highly physically grounded circumstances that enable digital culture are very much a part of it. So is technocultures something outside of that? I'm not really asking you that question. I'm just like kind of thinking through, continuing that through line. because I like distinguishing, I like the idea of distinguishing technocultures from digital culture, at least at the current moment, digital culture, albeit a very, very useful and important way of thinking about the world and expanding what we can do or what isn't, what is possible and what is not possible, who is included and who is not included. Technocultures seem to offer the pathway of technical practices that are beyond the computer. But let's go on to the cyborg's prosody. You've already framed a lot of what the things that you're thinking about in certain ways right now. Would you talk specifically about the cyborg's prosody and this amazing creative media award from Mozilla that you received?
Sure. I will say that I highly encourage people to just apply to things, because for me, when I applied to the Creative Media Award, I just didn't think that I would. I kind of thought, oh, this is a long shot. And I remember finishing the application, because this is the cyborg's prosody is something that I've been thinking about and dreaming up for a while. A lot of it has to do with my explorations in feminist media history, is as much as it does to do with computational media, and more specifically, you know, voice banking and voice cloning. And I'm not so much interested in deep fakes. I think I've been asked that question quite a bit, and I'm not interested in kind of the, you know, entertainment factor of it, but I am very fully aware that a lot of voice cloning happens for games. And there is kind of that adjacent relationship that I have in my own examinations and research of, you know, how that works and how, you know, voice is oftentimes seen as this, and it's so imperialist, and I feel it's so colonialist when people describe things as frontiers, because the voice is kind of seen as that. And the reason why I say that is because more and more, I think people will see voice activation. I mean, you see it now. We see it through smart speakers. You see voice activated architecture. Cars are like that too. I'm saying all of this as a kind of foundation to how I was thinking about cyborg's prosody.
Would you explain for everyone what cyborg's prosody is?
So the cyborg's prosody is an interactive docu-poetics. I'm calling it game. If you would like to call it an experience, you can. And it has five varying levels. Those five levels correspond with the stages of grief. And that's stages of grief as written about by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I wanted that as a framing. And throughout the game, there is an easy level to a difficult level. That's obviously level one to level five. And level one is all in English, but you are essentially repeating the cyborg and the prosody of the cyborg. And so there's words and phrases that you have to say in order to advance in the game, to hear and to listen to the rest of the stories. Now, the voice is a Filipino accented voice. And a big part of why that was really important for me was because I was deeply inspired by, again, as I've mentioned, Filipino workers in call centers or even serving as virtual agents in the Philippines, since the Philippines is if not the number one, it rivals India as the country in the world that has the most call center and virtual agents that do and must perform in this kind of Western vocal drag. And so what that means is the emergence of accent reduction schools has, you know, and even accent reduction media. So whether it's TikTok, Snapchat, or I don't, you know, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, there's a lot of media that is geared towards people, not even just Filipinos, but people that have a non-dominant accent. And what I mean by that is the lingua franca is two primary Englishes, which is American and British. And so you all of a sudden have to think about, well, what does it mean to reduce your accent? You are basing it off of a type of American or British accent. And so the cyborg's prosody essentially at its core was a response to that, because I really wanted it as a satire and as a parody. And I wanted to create an accent induction school. But what ended up happening was the focusing on my mom's story, because I thought, well, what is going to be the most meaningful, closest thing that I have experienced and that I've listened to growing up, and it's my mother's voice and how she has suppressed and eradicated in some aspects, or tried to fit in and to assimilate and to acculturate into American culture. And my own contentious kind of feelings around not being taught Tagalog, because my parents, but in particular my mom, thought, well, you're just going to get confused. And then the irony that the first language I learned outside or in addition to American English was Spanish. And then I spoke English and Spanish fluently, but I spoke it with a Tagalog accent when I was a kid. And, you know, so that's where a lot of the cyborg's prosody is actually rooted from.
There's an inherently global technocultures quality to that right there. And I mean this in the best possible sense, a kind of bastardization of the expectation of traditionalism in a pure sense. That's such a distinctly Californian circumstance, and maybe even like a Bay Area / LA circumstance. As you're describing, thank you for describing what the project is. I think that is helpful. And it's an app. So presumably you would be experiencing this on a phone or something like that. If you were to be playing it.
Well, for the sake of the project, I think also because I'm working on having it be a website, but then the website is optimized for mobile, because I think it's much more natural to speak to a phone than it is to your laptop. And those are the types of considerations that I've been thinking about as I'm writing and, you know, trying to collaborate with folks on this.
No, that's extraordinarily clever. The object is already well suited, and there's already such a history of the phone as a speaking object. I guess, again, back to that kind of question of technocultures, right? Is like, that gives the opportunity. I immediately think about the history of the family phone and its relationship to the history of electrification in the late 1800s and all of the kind of cultural anxieties that came along with introducing an object that could capture the private conversations of the home space into a public domain. I say that about technocultures because we don't tend to think at this moment in time very often, say, about like a rotary phone as like technoculture necessarily. That's history. But in fact, what you're talking about renders such a legacy of the performance of voice. As you're saying all this to me, I'm looking back over at domain errors and realizing how much of this reconstruction school for the accent could be seen similarly to the reskinning that is happening in domain errors. Could you maybe talk about that? I want to read one of the early pages in your Choose Your Own Adventure text game that's called Domain Errors, that for everyone who's listening is published by an art journal. And a link for it will actually be included in this podcast website. It's a text and click-based game. And one of the pages says, in Lucia Somer's essay, In/Visible Body, Notes on Biotechnology's Vision, she asks the following question. How does the body, that most vulnerable of territories, fare in the relentless expression of the sight machine? And you create in this story, Dorothy, create in this text-based game, a laboratory for new forms of visibility or invisibility through skin grafting, kind of. it is a speculative story, but it gets at these highly important ethical, cultural, survival questions of visibility versus invisibility. And when you talk about your mom, the cyborg's prosody being kind of inspired by your mom's story and the story of language, that is like the speech act of language, the words that you hear from her, it makes me wonder how her own code shifting happened, whether she was speaking to you in English versus Tagalog, for example, and if that changed your, she didn't want to teach you Tagalog, but in speaking to you in different languages, different visibilities and invisibilities were probably rendered present. And I'm not asking you to share with me what those were in the case of your mom. Rather, I'm asking if you could talk about the relationship between this invisible versus visible body in domain errors in relationship to cyborg's prosody. And while one's text-based, the other's voice-based, one's about the body, one's about the voice, there seems to be a deep connection.
Yeah, because you need a body in order to produce voice. So, I mean, I think for me, that's the initial visceral kind of gut reaction in seeing throughways between or a thread between domain errors and cyborg's prosody. I didn't even think of that because, you know, it's not that they're two separate things, but I am also thinking of, like, you know, Michelle Sion's work with acousmatic voice and, you know, where is this voice coming from? Where's the source of it? And a lot of why people probably within the sciences I'm speaking kind of more organically as I'm talking to you and answering the question, but I think this is the reason why people are so fascinated by the occult or by, you know, science in and of itself or technology having some kind of mysticism to it. Like, you know, when people first heard voices, when Bell and Watson were testing out this new invention of the box phone. And I just came back actually from San Antonio. I spent a few days at the AT&T Archives and History Center there with Bill and Scott, who are my new friends there, the archivists there. But I'm mentioning this because that was seen as unnatural. You know, and I think a lot of technology is always oftentimes seen as unnatural because people don't know it. And at the time, people marveled at, oh my gosh, how can we hear a voice from a great distance? You know, I think that that is kind of a connection and adjacent to invisibility versus visibility, because, you know, if you fast forward to now, people barely talk on the phone. And if they do, it's oftentimes connected to an emergency or having to communicate something that was not easily communicated or converted or transmitted through text, you know, or people leave like voice memos because it's this kind of, there's not this interaction. It's just like, let me just talk at you and then say the thing that I want to say. But having conversation in 2022 is much more challenging because people are also making these connections of being on the go. So there's a type of, there's invisibility versus visibility means something different in 2022 than it did when the phone just came out, you know, or was first just released at the turn of the, you know, 19th century. And, you know, when I think about the cyborg's prosody and prosody for people who are not familiar, everyone has a different prosody. It's like my prosody is that sometimes many Californians do this. It's just, you kind of raise an octave at certain parts of your speech. You know, it's kind of the animation, the color, the tonality of your voice. But the reason why I say this is because most people don't know what my mother would look like. So to a certain extent, she's rendered only visible, and I put scare quotes around that, through the imagination of the listener and someone who is engaged in copying and or mimicking her prosody in the game, versus Domain Errors, which was a title that was inspired by Sub Rosa's book, Domain Errors. I'm a huge fan of that collective that first came out of CMU with like Faith Wielding and, you know, Lucia Somners and Maria Fernandez, you know, just they were looking at, you know, biotech and more specifically, as you mentioned earlier, a feminist kind of techno science. And, you know, and kind of contemporaneously, I think of people like Tao Fan, who is also working through that lens within voice recognition and speech generation technologies, but looking at misrecognition. And I love how people can kind of think through games in that way. I feel that I found my niche, that I love click-through games. I love hypertext games. I love the fact that people might find frustration, because I'm not trying to create excruciating discomfort with my audience, but I'm wanting to create enough discomfort that someone says, how do I feel about mimicking this speech, and saying, I feel wrong for this, but then also saying, hold on, I actually learn language by mimicking. And the only reason why I think this is wrong is because I'm affecting an accent that I am performing. So there is that tension there that I'm causing, or I'm wanting for the game experience to cause in the listener. And that kind of, as you mentioned, renders certain things visible versus invisible, and the mechanisms that go into disciplining a body, essentially.
Yeah, that's maybe that question of disciplining is maybe that shared link between domain errors and cyborg's prosody that I was, you expressed with better words than I. I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about, you started to get at this for a moment, why in 2022, something like the codifying of accents or uncodifying of accents matters?
Totally. Okay. So the reason why the codifying of languages and accents matters to me is because we are starting to see voice being used in a multitude of ways. I mean, we're starting to also see this in film and digital media. I think there was a film that came out with, I'm not sure if it was Zoe Kravitz, who was the star of this movie called Kimmy or Kim. I think it's Kimmy, but it takes place in Seattle, obviously, because it's akin to, you know, where Amazon is based. And then it's based on smart speaker technology and the use of the voice, and then its relationship to data tracking, and, you know, and how machines are always listening. And again, there was something I read, this is many, many moons ago, when I first got out of undergrad in the early aughts, right at 2000, when I graduated. I actually worked for a corporate real estate firm. Not a lot of people know that. It was very short-lived. It was only like a couple of years. But I got really curious, and my mom is actually the one that suggested, she's like, oh, do you know that the engineer you were working with, because in that previous life in corporate real estate, I did do a lot of HTML. I learned CSS, and I learned how, you know, basic programming, so that I could actually run the client intranet. And one of the things that's kind of what got me into programming at a very kind of novice level and really got me into it. But the engineer, clearly he's still there. I was fascinated by what he's working on now, which he's working on voice activated architecture. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why I started thinking, oh, well, I see a lot of this nowadays, or even my own friends that are using Amazon or Amazon's Alexa and, you know, Google Nest. And I do have these devices for research purposes, or even the Amazon Halo, where Amazon speculated, well, if people knew what their tone sounded like, maybe people would communicate better. But then what that does is, as I mentioned, and I'm very fervent about this, that is yet another way of disciplining the body, is you do that through speech. And it's not just this codifying of what sounds nice, what sounds pleasant, what sounds confident. It is also what sounds scary, intimidating, distrustful, contemplative, etc. What sounds trusting, like, you know, it's so fascinating when people say, oh, you know, I can trust this person. Well, what can you trust about this person? And oftentimes people will say, you know, phenotypically a face, you know, people will smile. My sister is not a smiler. So, or would people say that she's an untrustworthy person? And then you flip it and say, well, what other things can you say are connotations of what makes someone trusting? And then a lot of people talk about voice and talk about intonation. And then people forget that some people have suffered, you know, I think of Jonathan Stern with his latest book, Diminished Faculties, and how he had to actually use what he pegged or what he coined as a dorkophone, but especially because he had to go through a period of time where he lost his voice. And so he had to wear what he calls a dorkophone, but it's essentially another mouthpiece. So then what does it mean to perform with what he called like two mouths? so that there's this auxiliary to your body, which is an extension that amplifies your voice, but also is a type of technology that it, as it enables, what does it simultaneously disable? And so those are the types of things that I think about and why for me voice is so, I mean, I can go so many directions with this because I'm also looking at how the voice is trained, not just through, not just operators and telephone operators of super, super late 18th or 19th century and then the 20th century, but I'm also talking about 911 dispatchers because that's kind of the last, for me, emergency infrastructures are this kind of like vocal terrain that people forget because they have become so ingrained in what we need when we're in crisis, but not understanding that 911 operators and call center agents and virtual agents, they are trained in a very specific way to perform with their voice. Will 911 dispatchers ever be replaced by a phone tree or an interactive voice response system? I hope not. You know, I'd like to think that cannot be the case because there's something like a machine will never have intuition. And sometimes these are the types of complexities of human voice that are just too difficult to, you cannot program that. I don't care what Marvin Minsky says, you know, Marvin Minsky's all about, we'll know we've reached the super intelligence when we have machines that can talk in the same tonality and, you know, prosody or whatever. He didn't say that verbatim, but that was one of the things he kind of claimed. And I remember, you know, again, a shared mentor for us is Soraya Murray. And I remember Soraya asked me this question because we were having conversation. I said, well, who would disagree with me? Who would disagree with what I'm trying to say about why we should be looking at voice and we should care about how assistive technologies are built? And she goes, oh, easy, Marvin Minsky. Yeah. But yeah, those are some of the reasons why. So many.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks so much for pushing that and maybe also holding back too, because you're right. I mean, when you say there's so many directions, it seems so self-evident right away. I mean, there's not only just the question of how voice is disciplined, but also the much larger question, I think, of what you started to get at, which is like the body auxiliary and the idea perhaps that voice doesn't even begin with speech at all, right? It begins, like you said, with the body, and not even necessarily. Our bodies could be synthetic bodies. It could be non-human bodies. It could be all manner celestial bodies. I mean, there is both future facing and deep historical perspectives on the harmony of the spheres and whatnot. I mean, also, I guess we take for granted the more we dwell in the digital culture of the present, I think we perhaps take for granted the long durée of that disciplining process. One doesn't take on their speech patterns, let alone the sort of cultural significance of performing speech quickly. I mean, devices do tend to change habits because they create new ones, but that doesn't, like the path of overcoming, say, the xenophobia associated with what amounts to a good voice or a bad voice has a very long history that doesn't even need recording technologies necessarily to illustrate. And so it seems to me you're confronting the now with a kind of challenging reckoning there of how to, I guess the question there becomes, to flip it from a kind of removing or scraping away of these dilemmas, can you talk about a pathway towards, I mean, audio activated architecture, audio responsive media, auditory technologies in our environment are only going to become increasingly more common. So can you provide a kind of, I mean, I think critical thinkers hate these kind of questions, right? Because it's not really the point. And so pardon me for putting it forward, but could you paint any picture of what an open-ended alternative auditory framework of assistive audio technologies might look like?
I love how the question is both highly specific, but also broad simultaneously, because it allows me to kind of dream a little bit, but also about this very specific thing. And one of the first people that comes to mind, who's also a mentor and a scholar I deeply admire, Helesian M. Lawrence. And, you know, she wrote the essay Siri Disciplines for the anthology Your Computer is on Fire. And one of the things she points to towards the end is open source software. So what does it mean to have artists that are committed? Well, more specifically, I'm talking about artists and, you know, having witnessed and having been a part of Processing Foundation since 2018 and now being on this kind of new path of, you know, how we create public programming that's much more expansive, much more inclusive and accessible. That's something that I've been thinking about is, you know, and even thinking about this through having worked with Gabi Shofson, who is a professor over, assistant professor over at York University, but we also did work together with Liat Verdugo and Lisa Cartwright, you know, a few years ago for the Humanities Research Institute through UC Santa Cruz, and really through the UCs. And even those conversations of expanding and going beyond machines and devices, like what would it mean to subvert a pen plotter? You know, Gabi was looking at, you know, human measurement. And then for me, I was thinking about, you know, again, still choose your own adventure games. And I was thinking about a work that I had kind of worked through that was also a choose your own adventure, but it wasn't textual. It was actually all auditory. So you had to make choices listening to my voice because I was narrating a story about a particular experience of the listener is like a clinical trial subject that has to make a decision about how their DNA is banked or if they want that media to even exist beyond them. And that all happens within a very kind of artistic, creative space that I've seen as possible and probable and has so much potential within open source software for the arts specifically. I know that there's so many kind of permutations and instantiations of what open source software is, but more specifically within the arts, that's where I see a lot of what needs to happen and the changes that need to be made around the ethics of licensing as well happen. And I think a lot of larger tech companies could learn from that, but at the same time can be in better conversation with. I'm not saying that that's a solution by any means. I'm trust me, I don't know how I would feel if a big tech company were to say, let's partner with Processing Foundation. Those are also complicated issues and kind of intersections to deal with too. Is I think Elizabeth Travels Light, who is a longtime friend and collaborator, a Bay Area based artist, said it best, you know, like let's make certain everyone is fed and then we can worry about the dance lessons after. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, what would it look like if we started to, and I to circle back around the reason why I mentioned Gabi is because we have this kind of ongoing conversation because he's so his scholarship is so steeped in disability studies. And one of the things he said to me is like, wow, what if that was just the default that we created for accessibility purposes instead of something that is nice to have? What if it is something that we need to have? And so that's what I think about when I think about voice recognition, speech generation, assistive technologies is, what do we need? What do people need? Not just something that is fanciful and entertaining. And again, this kind of scratches the surface. I feel like I'm barely saying anything.
I mean, I set you up for that a little bit with the unanswerable question, but I think that that was a really lovely response. And I'm really glad you mentioned the Processing Foundation. You managed to find a way to very organically move over into that domain, because I did want to ask you about your work in the nonprofits art and technology sector. You are the executive director of the Processing Foundation. And so similar to what I was asking you earlier on in our conversation, like how does that fit in with your practice writ large, you kind of just answered that, but would you take a moment also just to share kind of what the Processing Foundation is and does?
Sure. The Processing Foundation is a nonprofit. We're 501c3. That's our status. And we are focused on open source software for artists. Much more specifically, we are focused on our software, on supporting the software projects that are kind of underneath that umbrella. So Processing, P5.js, P5, the P5 editor, Processing for Python, Android, et cetera, and the list goes on, and hundreds of libraries that contributors are creating, but also maintaining. A lot of the work that we do there really relies on our fellowship program. That's an annual program where artists, hobbyists, educators, technologists can, you know, not just only work on a project or a research project that is using one of the software projects, but it's also expanding what the software itself can do, pushing its limits. I think a lot of what we're also excited about is, and that we continue on with another initiative that we're working on, is Processing Community Day. And it's not a conference. It's more, I want to say it's a day-long event that, depending on where it's located, because we had one over at the MIT Media Lab in 2017. We had another iteration of it in 2019 at UCLA. And, you know, obviously due to the pandemic, we have not been able to do another kind of physical in-person event, but we've been doing a lot of PCDs, so Processing Community Days, virtually. And we've pivoted a lot of community building online, which has been really rewarding, illuminating, but also challenging. We do so much. Shen Chen Ye, or Q, as known by community members within the P5 space, has recently organized, and there are recordings online that people can view, P5 Access Day. So the entire day was focused on presentations about not just community building, but we are talking about translation work, because accessibility is, yes, addressing low vision, blind users, community members that really want to focus on how we incorporate accessibility within not just the building of the, you know, of the software, but also the maintenance of the code base. You know, in addition to that, it's also about how we translate that to the rest of the world. Speaking of lingua franca, but there's so many things that we do and are doing. And I feel the connection that it has with my own work is I do rely on a lot of the scholarship and work and the community organizing, the activism, the leadership that I see amongst younger community members working in not just the new media digital space, but the open source software space, where if, you know, it's really exciting to see younger people make things that don't exist, or they feel, I don't see this particular thing that I need for this project, so I'm just going to build it. And how exciting that is to see a lot of this collaborative work happening within community that I feel deeply influences the work that I do. I think it informs a lot of, especially with my own research within computational media, how open source software for artists, or sorry, open source software for the arts, it is a movement, as exhausting and as tiring as it can be, because I've seen firsthand a lot of the volunteerism that has gone into maintaining these softwares. It also speaks to kind of the relentlessness of projects being maintained for the sake of a public that needs it.
What a lovely sentiment that is. I mean, often there are special spaces in the domain of digital preservation or digital archives or media archaeology that periodically produce phrases that render so clear the importance of sustaining digital cultural heritage, but also the ways in which such stewardship produces other possible futures that are desperately needed. I think what you just said was such a wonderful way of articulating that. I mean, and clearly Processing Foundation has built up a foundation upon which such
creative and radical and diverse artists around the world, and not just artists, all manner of cultural producers rely on. But speaking of lingua franca, as precisely as you said, right, like not just reimagining how tools can be used, but literally like building them as they go. Also, how long ago was it when you started saying phrases like, it's great to see younger people engaged, dot, 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 dot?
Yeah, I love that actually. Or that you pointed that out.
So I have, we're getting right at time, and I have one big question. You know what that question is, but I also, what everything you just said made me, it connected all of the assistive audio technology research you're doing in a particular way. Am I right to assume that blind users of processing are using assistive audio technology, or is it some other assistive technology to provide other able-bodied individuals ways to use processing?
Well, no, that the former is correct. I think that's what, you know, I think of Matura and Luis, who were past fellows for Processing Foundation. They created P5 Accessibility, which was focused on low vision and blind users of processing and more specifically P5, and enabling that type of technology to really focus on the needs of, yes, you know, blind and low vision users who really wanted to make art. And so I feel a lot of that is, again, just been very inspiring for me to kind of think through as I'm, you know, thinking about accessibility and also its ties to emergency infrastructures and kind of the thornier issue of how emergency infrastructures are also inextricably linked to law enforcement. So I'm just thinking on all the threads about that. But circling back to Processing Foundation, yeah, that's just, you understood correctly.
What a wonderful thing to be able to start from a kind of docu-poetics place within your own practice and then see in the context of processing this extraordinarily practical use of assistive audio technologies and essentially lay out the whole gamut of the ways that such technologies become transformative tools in the world. So thank you for giving us that opportunity to think about that. So Dorothy, you know, in the whole context of this podcast about global cultural exchange within technocultures, but also a personal interest of mine, probably as you know, because I, much like you, have my hands in many different areas of practice. One of my interests is to link together these disparate practices, whether we're talking about like the tech sector proper, like big tech, or academia, or media arts, or the art and tech nonprofit world, or design, which I think of as its own space amongst that, is to imagine what the crucial issues facing technocultures past, present, and future are, and what kind of interventions, subversions, what kind of concepts, refigurings, retoolings are needed to imagine the world as we, you know, scare quotes around that, we want to see. So for this podcast, for yourself, for me, what is the question that you would ask to a guest on this program? If this program is a program about technocultural exchange, what would you ask them? And why is that an important question to ask?
I would ask them, are we allowed to forget in the future? And how might we think about that function of forgetting in human cognition and apply it to our daily lives? And I ask this because we have been kind of coerced, forced, introduced, whatever people want to say, to a variety of platforms, whether it be social media and even through our devices, an inescapable path or paths that seem to document our lives in a way that we might have not ever imagined. And so I wonder if there is room and space for forgetting, or maybe perhaps in the spirit of Brenda Holder, withholding. And if that is possible, how might that be a good thing?
Yeah, you said at the beginning that that question would spurn a whole possible conversation. And perhaps now I'm regretting we didn't attack that. Attack is a weird metaphor to use.
I'm thinking about it in the musical term. That's fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, let's get that envelope straight.
Yeah.
What an interesting conversation that would be. Unfortunately, and thank you for that question. That is a conversation will unfold as a result of you asking that question, just unfortunately not with you. It's a very interesting question, a question that I'm really interested in the idea of forgetting myself. I would say yes to your question. I think not knowing is another way maybe I would put forgetting. And it seems to me that not knowing is a really, really important thing. Everyone who is listening, you'll have to wait until next month to hear what kind of conversation or what answer will be given to that question. I didn't realize there'd be a hook on the show, but there it is. There's the hook. Dorothy, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for taking the time to speak on the Signals podcast. Once again, everyone, my name is Eli Vargas. Signals podcast is a project by the Goethe Institute in collaboration with Gray Area and the Current Sea Change Initiative. Signals is a monthly podcast. It will be coming out monthly on the Signals digital magazine. Thanks everyone for listening. Until next time.